Well, hi, I'm Matt, one of the leaders at Maybridge. Great to be with you today. We're slowly working our way through Matthew's Gospel as a church, one of the greatest and most influential things ever written. And the purpose of it and why we're looking at it is that it's all about what it means to be a follower or a disciple of Jesus. You could say the whole of Matthew, all 28 chapters, is trying to persuade us to be all in with Jesus, to be fully on board. And yet, as we'll see today, it gives us plenty of examples of people who knew Jesus, who saw him up close, and yet still struggled to really be all in as a follower of his. So if you're battling with doubts, or you've been a Christian for decades, or you know, you're just exploring the whole thing, this is for you. Up to this point in Matthew, we've had 10 chapters, everything's going quite well, Jesus is doing all sorts of amazing things, he's become well known, all good. And then chapters 11 to 13 are a bit of a change. What happens is that people start asking big questions. They get disappointed that Jesus isn't what they thought he should be. But the first person who has big questions is maybe the last person you'd expect. Let's have a look. This is the start of Matthew chapter 11. After Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach in the towns of Galilee. When John, who was in prison, heard about the deeds of the Messiah, he sent his disciples to ask him, "Are you the one who is to come? Or should we expect someone else?" So Jesus is doing normal Jesus things. He's teaching, drawing crowds. And then John pops up with a question. This John is the John that we refer to as John the Baptist. And he's not called that because he was a Baptist minister, but because he baptized lots of people. It probably would make more sense to call him John the Baptizer. But before this particular moment, here's what we already know about John. Here's his story so far. He's part of Jesus' family. He's literally Jesus' cousin. His mum was the sister of Jesus' mum, Mary. So he's known Jesus pretty much his whole life. He's an amazingly popular preacher. Before Jesus did any public ministry, John was out preaching in the wilderness and he had an amazing influence. Thousands of people came into the countryside to hear his message and be baptized. He knows who Jesus really is before anybody else. He's ahead of the game. He points lots of people to Jesus. He stands up to powerful people, to kings and rulers, and he has no problem with doing so. He speaks truth even when it's not wanted, so he was willing to say difficult things and he didn't care about popularity whatsoever, and it actually gets him into trouble. Basically, John was amazing. He was incredible. But John begins to have doubts. He begins to question whether all this Jesus stuff he's really been believing is all true. Like many teachers of the day, John had disciples and he sends them to Jesus to represent him. John doesn't go himself because he's in prison. And the reason he's in prison is that he annoyed Herod, the king. And what had happened is that Herod was sleeping with his brother's wife and then he married her. Terrible behaviour. And John basically just told him off. And now John's rotting in jail and he wants to know, is it worth it? Have I actually put my faith in the right place or am I just completely crazy? I've been telling everyone that the Messiah promised by the Old Testament is on the way. I've been certain that it's you, Jesus. Now I'm wondering, have I got it wrong? Are you really him? Are you really the person? And you'd think that John would be the last person in the world to have doubts. This is almost like the Pope saying, I'm not really sure I'm Catholic after all. But John asks Jesus, are you the one who is to come? Or should we expect someone else? Now in a moment we'll look at how Jesus responds. But before that, let's dive into what's happening here. Because John isn't the first or the last person to ever doubt his beliefs. Today we live in the age of doubts, you could say. It's fashionable to critique things, to sit on the fence, to be sceptical about everything, to see through everything that you're told. And you can see why. We're more aware than ever that there are lies out there. It's often hard to know who's telling the truth. And of course, all of us feel better about ourselves if we're not tricked by somebody else's lies. It makes us feel clever. And if we're honest, sometimes it makes us feel a little bit superior. On the back of this, many people who are not Christians, in my experience, think, for some reason, that Christians don't think about what their faith is at all and just believe what they're told, which is not true. We were given brains to work things out and we're supposed to use them to reason and discover truth. But what I find is really helpful is making clear the difference between doubt and unbelief. Doubt and unbelief, because they're not the same thing. Unbelief is refusing to believe. Unbelief is when you stubbornly refuse. It's not about evidence or arguments. It's an underlying refusal to believe, though probably a better word than belief is trust. Unbelief is not trusting God and just trusting yourself instead. It's saying, I will remain as the driver, the pilot, the person in control in my life. Thank you very much. And I won't even entertain any other idea. Doubt, on the other hand, is struggling to believe. Doubt is different. Doubt is when you're honestly asking questions and you want answers. It's when you're in a battle to trust God. Here's an example of what I mean. When we have a family dinner, my kids are really fussy eaters. We make them perfectly good food, but sometimes they refuse to even have it on the table in front of them. They'll push it away or onto the floor. And that's unbelief. They won't even look at the thing. That's unbelief. But sometimes they have the food in front of them and they hold a fork and they tentatively pick up something green and they're pulling faces and they slowly move it towards their mouth. That's doubt. They're not sure. They're not quite convinced. But at least they're engaging. And if they're engaging, they can taste and see. And if we're lucky, they'll realise that we're not trying to poison them and we can work with that. Unbelief and doubt. Everyone struggles with both of them at different times. Sometimes our problem is just that we want to be in control. Other times our problem is that we're simply struggling to trust God for whatever reason. Usually it's our circumstances that are making us feel that way. And so left to our own devices, it's difficult. We're limited beings. We don't know everything. We're used to being told lies and half-truths all the time, so we're cynical. Plus, we're all more likely to believe what we want to be true. All the studies say this. What we want to be true is always going to appeal to us more. We're not as rational and reasonable as we'd all like to believe. But see here that Jesus treats doubt and unbelief differently. Next week, we'll look at how he treats unbelief. But here we see that Jesus doesn't tell people off for doubt. People experiencing doubt do not stress him out. He's relaxed about it. Jesus replied, "Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me." At this point in the story, Jesus is becoming very well known. How does he react to his number one supporter having doubts about the whole thing? Does he get angry with him and say, "John, pull yourself together. Don't ask questions. Just try harder. Just don't think about it." No, not at all. Jesus responds gently, but look at how he points to the evidence. He doesn't ask for unquestioning faith. He says, "The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor." Jesus is saying, "Look, John, I'm smashing it. I'm doing it. I'm doing the things that you expect the Messiah to do." Now, these words are a direct quote from Isaiah 61 in the Old Testament, and they were verses that many people thought pointed forwards to the Messiah, the special person God would send to save the world. And John has been completely committed to the idea that Jesus was this Messiah, and now he's wondering, as we said, if he should be so certain. Jesus' answer is, "Look, Isaiah 61 is happening. I'm doing it. Look at the evidence." And the thing is, none of this is new to John. He knows what Jesus is up to. But there's a sort of message within a message here. If you read all of Isaiah 61 verse 1, it says the stuff about good news to the poor and blinding the brokenhearted, and then it says something about proclaiming freedom to the captives. Proclaim freedom from the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners. When Jesus sends a message to John, he leaves out the last bit about freeing captives and prisoners. It's like he's saying, "John, I am this person. I'm doing these amazing things. I will set free captives and prisoners. But I'm not setting you free right now. I am the Messiah you hoped for, but I'm not the Messiah in exactly the way that you want. I'll free captives, but John, I'm not coming to free you from prison today. That's not in the plan." You may have been in a similar position to John yourself. You know the right answers. You know who Jesus is. You believe he does things in people's lives even today. Maybe the person who sat next to you has been healed of something. The thing that's messing up their life has been taken away. Or things just go well for them. And you think, "Well, that's great. But what about me? I believe this stuff. Why aren't things getting better for me?" And if they're not, is Jesus really who he says he is? After the Isaiah 61 quote, Jesus simply says, "Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me." To be blessed was the Greek word makarios, which means to be fortunate or happy or well. To stumble was the Greek word skandalistia, which is the word from which we get scandal, which means to get anger or shock because of what's been said. And it seems Jesus is saying, Bless you, John, if you're not scandalised by me. Don't stumble. Don't fall into sin. Don't mistrust God because of me. And this might seem like a strange thing to say, because if Jesus is this great Messiah figure, why would anyone stumble on him? Well, plenty of people through history have sadly hated Jesus, but I think here this stumbling is about struggling with him because he doesn't meet your expectations. That was John's problem. It's one thing to recognise who Jesus is in a factual sense, but it's another thing to trust him when he doesn't do the things that you'd like him to do. Jesus, I know who you are. I've lived for you. I've followed you. I've even told other people about you. But how can I trust you if you don't spring me out of jail? Or heal my friend? Or provide the money I need? Or change the situation at work? Or give hope to my child who's battling depression? Or end this blooming pandemic? Where are you? Why aren't you fixing this? Jesus simply says, you're blessed if you don't stumble on account of me. But look at what happens next. As John's disciples were leaving, Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed swayed by the wind? If not, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in fine clothes? No, those who wear fine clothes are in king's palaces. So John's guys leave, and that could have been it, change of subject. But Jesus turns to the crowd and talks about John. Now notice he asks lots of questions. He wants the crowd to reason with him. There's no call to unthinking belief here. Not long before this, they'd all been out into the wilderness to hear John preach. There was something about him and his message that drew them in. And Jesus says, was he a reed swayed by the wind? Now, reeds in that area were 15-foot tall things. If it was even slightly windy, you could see them really bending over. But also remember Herod, the king who imprisoned John? Herod had coins minted which had his own face on one side and a reed in the wind on the other. And a reed in the wind had become a figure of speech to describe a politician who was flaky or double-minded, maybe because it became associated with Herod's leadership. So Jesus seems to be saying to the crowd, you didn't come into the wilderness to hear Herod, did you? You weren't listening to a flaky politician. You know there was substance to John and what he said. You heard him for yourself. And then he continues, then what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it was written, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. Prophets were people in the Old Testament who represented God to the people and spoke words of truth to them, sometimes reassuring, often very uncomfortable. And Jesus is saying, yes, John is one of those guys. He's like that. But actually, he's even more than that. About 400 years before Jesus said this, the last book of the Old Testament, Malachi, records the words of Malachi, unsurprisingly. And he said, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. In the ancient world, before a king came to a city, they would send a representative on ahead to announce that they were on the way. And Malachi says, there'll be a representative, a messenger coming, which tells you that the king is on the way. One way you will know this Messiah is coming is that his ambassador will show up first. And so Jesus, in effect, says, John is that messenger. He is the exact person Malachi was talking about because I am the king that he was preparing for. And then he adds some more to the story. Truly I tell you, among those born of women, there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Yet whoever is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has been subjected to violence and violent people have been raiding it. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you're willing to accept it, he is the Elijah who was to come. Whoever has ears, let them hear. This is great. Having just responded to John's concerns, Jesus faces the crowd and basically says, John is the greatest person in the world. He publicly gives him loads of praise. He doesn't criticise him for having doubts. No, John can have doubts and still be the greatest person who has ever lived up to this point. And then Jesus says this stuff about the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is not some mystical place where everyone floats around on clouds and plays harps. The kingdom of heaven is where the ways of heaven are lived out on earth here and now. It's something that's both already here and yet not fully here but on the way. When John had started his public ministry of telling people to get ready for the Messiah, he was announcing this kingdom. The king is on the way. The kingdom's coming. This is what the law of the prophets, the Old Testament, was all pointing to. The kingdom has also been subject to violence. Some people have responded well. Many people have opposed it. And of course, John has ended up in prison. The stakes are high. But in this kingdom that Jesus is talking about, John, as great as he was, is less than the least person. How can that be? I don't feel like I'm any greater than John. Well, think of it like this. Imagine it's 1900 and everyone still travels around in horse-drawn carriages and you're the greatest carriage builder in the world. And then in 1908, Henry Ford starts mass-producing cars and they're revolutionary. All of a sudden, it's better to be at the bottom of Ford's company than the top of your own company. Something has changed the world order. And Jesus is saying that it's like that with John. He's the greatest of the old order. He's like Elijah, who was a big name Old Testament prophet. He's the one who was sent to prepare the way. But now the king is here, it's this whole new thing. And so whoever has ears, let them hear. Jesus was doing loads of Messiah stuff, all the Isaiah 61 stuff and more besides. But he doesn't jump up and down going, I'm the Messiah. But if you're paying attention, you'll know. If you have ears to hear, you'll get it. If you've committed yourself to unbelief, you won't get it because you're not listening. Like my kids, you won't even let the meal sit on the table in front of you. But if you struggle with doubt, think about what this story has to say to you. Here's John the Baptizer's guide to doubt. Firstly, be honest about your doubts, regardless of your position. Sometimes Christians get into this mindset that expressing their doubts might be wrong in some way. And I think this feeling gets stronger if you've been a follower of Jesus for a long time. You sort of think, well, I can't have doubts. I've been a Christian for ages. Or if you're a leader in some way, sometimes it feels like there's no space where it's okay to say you have doubts. You don't want to burden other people, maybe. But look at John. He was a nationally famous spiritual leader. Loads of people have been moved greatly by what he had to say. It would have been easy for him to keep his doubts to himself. Not that it would have been good for him. But he doesn't. He talks about them. He must have shared them with his disciples because they speak to Jesus on his behalf. And so the example is here. Just be honest about your doubts. There's more authenticity and more real faith in speaking up and trying to move forward than just trying to bottle it all up and getting on with it. Secondly, be clear about what you doubt. I've found that when people have doubts, it's helpful to be able to say exactly what it is that you doubt. That's true whether you're a follower of Jesus or you're just exploring the whole thing. Personally, I don't think I've ever doubted that God is real. Ever. That just seems nonsensical to me. But I've had a number of times where I've doubted what God is like. Is he really as good as I've been led to believe? When John questions Jesus, John is not doubting whether God exists or whether God will do justice. His doubts are around Jesus. Jesus, are you the Messiah that the Old Testament promises? Is it you, or am I waiting for someone else? John knows what his question is. If you have doubts, what is it that you doubt exactly? Is it that you doubt whether God exists, whether he loves people, whether he acts in people's lives? Do you have doubts about Jesus? Do you have doubts about whether the Bible's reliable? The doubts people have often present as intellectual questions, and those are important. But usually I think it comes down to a deeper thing. Will I let myself trust God in a meaningful way? That's worth exploring with someone else. But you have to know what exactly it is that you have doubts about before you move anywhere. Thirdly, take your doubts to Jesus. If you've got doubts, do what John did and go to Jesus directly with them. Now you might say, well, hold on, I doubt Jesus even existed. How would I take my doubts to him? The thing is, if you're sincerely looking for truth, you can guarantee that Jesus will engage with anyone who's after it. So whatever your doubts about Jesus, is he real? Is he this Messiah? Is he trustworthy? Go to him. In other words, try praying your doubts. Look at the Jesus of the Gospels and see how his life responds to your questions. What we see in this passage is that Jesus doesn't condemn doubt. He affirms faith. Fourth thing, wrestle with the real Jesus. Every single follower of Jesus who has ever lived has to deal with the fact that although Jesus is the promised Messiah and he's the Son of God, he's God made flesh, his agenda is not the same as yours. The things you want, the things you value, the things you live for are not naturally the same as his. And what this means is, as you grow as a Christian, which includes doubt, you have to face the fact that when it comes down to it, he is not God in the way that you would like God to be. He's much better, but he's not exactly what you wanted. By nature, people don't want Jesus. They want Santa Claus. They want someone who will give them lots of presents if they are broadly sort of good people. But Jesus is not Santa. You have to have him on his own terms or not at all. If you have doubts about whether he's like Santa, well, he's not. He won't give you all the things that you think are best, but he is trustworthy to give you much, much better. And when you come to the real Jesus, you're not just getting a system of beliefs a worldview. You're getting a person, flesh and blood, and yet God at the same time, but a person. So at the end of the day, it's never just about being persuaded that certain things are true, although they are, but whether you can trust this person. And you can't do that unless you wrestle with who he really is on his terms. Fifth and finally, honestly seek the truth. In the passage of today, Jesus and John are the main characters, but Herod lurks in the background. He's the king at the time, he's an illegitimate king, he has power and wealth, but he's a reed in the wind. He doesn't have doubts, he has unbelief. He has nothing to do with Jesus, he doesn't want him, doesn't like anyone who points to him. Herod doesn't seek truth, he seeks the power and the praise of others. Jesus basically uses him as an example, quite a few times, of what not to be like. But John is a good example. He's in horrible circumstances, he feels isolated and sad in prison, because of course you would. What does he do? He doesn't let his circumstances tell him what's true. He gets his questions in the open because he wants answers. If you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, you need to ask yourself, is it truth that you're after, or something that will make you feel better about life? What Jesus has to say won't entirely be what you want to hear, but it is better. And I'm absolutely not going to say to you, just trust Jesus without thinking about it, have blind faith. That's not what Jesus does. No, the invitation is to honestly seek the truth as best you can. Nothing to hide. If you would call yourself a Christian, you might think, well, you know, I know the truth, I'm okay. But hold on. John lived this incredible life, and then he hit a season of great doubt and despair. That might happen to you. It might be happening right now. How are you going to handle it? The challenge of this text is, will you be clear about your doubts, take them to the real Jesus, and honestly seek the truth? Easier said than done. You know, when I think about it, following Jesus is a lot like getting married. When you get married, usually you know a fair bit about the other person, hopefully, that's advisable, but you don't know everything. You make 100% commitment, all in, money, resources, time, children, everything, but without 100% certainty. It's sort of what makes marriage special. The commitment isn't based on the certainty of knowing everything. You know some things, and then it's based on the trust which you build from what you know. Same with Jesus. You can't know everything, but you can trust him. You can build the trust over time. He's done everything already to deserve our trust, but just like with John, he doesn't condemn, but moves at our slow pace. And just look, just two final things, at the way that Jesus is throughout this passage. This is really important. This is the person that we're encouraging one another to trust. Firstly, he responds to John personally and encourages him, but he also challenges John's assumptions. John is the greatest person of the old order, but even he doesn't get it yet. And secondly, he speaks to the listening crowd and explains the wider story. When he speaks to other people, he doesn't criticise John or diminish what he's done. He doesn't tear him down the moment he shows some vulnerability. No, Jesus celebrates John, celebrates the faith and the important service that he's given. You can trust that Jesus' desire, when you have doubts, is not to embarrass you, but to help you. Let's pray. Father, thank you for everything we see in this passage. Thank you that you are the place we can take our doubts, that we can just admit our humanness, our uncertainty, our complete lack of knowledge about so many things. But thank you that at the end of the day, it's not about our cleverness or our reasoning abilities or the information that we have. Comes down to, do we trust a person? Do we trust you? And I pray you would compel us as a church further in that direction today, Lord, please. We're always going to have doubts, but it's also true that we can always, always grow in our trust of you and reap the rewards of doing so. Amen.